Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We're going to look today at the Gospel according to St. Luke, chapter 10, verses 25 to 37. It is obviously, probably, if not the most famous, one of the most famous passages in the Gospels, and it's what we call the story of the Good Samaritan. But it starts out in a most interesting way. It starts out in a typical kind of confrontation between Jesus and the lawyers of the law, the men of the law. And it starts out with a question which can sound kind of challenging and sounds in a way kind of disrespectful on the part of the man approaching Jesus. But this is where we have to begin to understand the mindsets of different people, because what we have here is a great example. We as Christians in the contemporary world encounter questions and challenges which it's very hard to respond to, because the two mindsets are so incompatible that they're unable to kind of penetrate the conversation. And so basically, if we respond in Christian terms to the secularist challenge, they dismiss us. And if we respond to their secularist challenge, and they respond to us in a secularist challenge, we tend to dismiss that. Because basically, there seems to be no answer to the questions as they clash. What we see here in the story of Jesus is Jesus gives us an example. He gives us an example of how you kind of circumvent the standoff, circumvent the impasse that comes with mindsets and the language which accompany those mindsets, and is able to go around the issue in such a way that it is able to respond in terms that are comprehensible, because what it deals with almost always is either a direct quote from the law or a human situation which opens the eyes of even the most obtuse person and even the most obstinate person. So what we see here is then is a lawyer who, Luke says, to disconcert Jesus. And so basically he wants to challenge Jesus. He wants to put, we've seen this so often, they come up, they want to put Jesus in a box is what they want to do. Because as soon as they can associate him with a particular partisan group within Judaism, then they can dismiss him as being, well, he's one of them. And we know that they and us don't agree on anything. If he's a Pharisee, then he's a Sadducee. If he's a Sadducee, then it's a Pharisee. So we're able to set up categories of people and dismiss them because of those categories. And that's exactly what this lawyer is attempting to do with Jesus. To disconcert him, he said, "Master, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And here we go to the whole question of the foundation of the notion of salvation. It has different meanings in Judaism. The Pharisees believed in the resurrection. The Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection, and so forth. And so you had different understandings of what salvation meant. And it took its fundamental root from the story of the Exodus, the idea of deliverance from slavery of some kind. And for those who did not believe in an afterlife, they saw, for instance, the violation of the law as an enslavement and the living of the law as a liberation from the foibles and the missteps of individual human persons. So here then, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What he's asking Jesus is, tell me which of the laws I must act upon and which of the laws I must accomplish if I am to receive eternal life. The lawyer, therefore, was most probably a member of the Pharisees, because he's talking about eternal life and not about deliverance from sin necessarily as an end, as the end in itself. And so Jesus, knowing that he's a lawyer, knows that what he wants him to do is select laws that must be observed and obeyed and accomplished. And that way, the lawyer will be able to debate with him about, well, if these laws are necessary, what about these laws? Are they not necessary? Are you therefore an opponent of Moses? Are you therefore an opponent of the law? And the debate was intended to go on for a very long time and never to reach a resolution, simply to end in both parties accepting the fact that the other party does not agree with them and presuming, of course, because of that, they are wrong. But Jesus does not do that. He says instead, what is written in the law? And what do you read there? And then the man says that he repeats what is called the Shema of Israel, the prayer that is a combination of things from of passages from Deuteronomy and from Leviticus, which is a prayer that modern-day Judaism also is very much attached to and very much a part of their prayer life. And so the Shema Israel, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. So the lawyer did know the fundamental law of the Torah. And when Jesus says what is written in the law, he's saying what is written in the Torah. And it is the lawyer then who abandons the particular laws he's trying to get Jesus, trap Jesus with, and he returns then to the Shema Israel. And in that, of course, he articulates the very foundation of the covenant between Israel and God, between God and peoples forever. But the man was anxious to justify himself, and so he said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And so here comes now the parable that for us is kind of has become even it's one of the biblical passages that has remained part and parcel of the of our contemporary discourse, our contemporary understanding of the relationship between peoples in crisis, and that is the Good Samaritan. And so he says, "Who is my neighbor?" Now, in this parable, if we listen closely to this parable, Jesus turns the question around, actually, and kind of the presumption is that it isn't the question of who is my neighbor, but the question of who am I a neighbor for. And so basically then he is interpreting the Shema Israel as us being neighbors to those around us, to all humanity, especially to those in need. And so Jesus replied, "A man was once on his way down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of brigands, and they took all that he had, beat him, and then made off, leaving him half dead." Now, the road from Jerusalem to Jericho is a descent. It is coming down from the heights into below sea level, actually, from around 2,600 feet to about 700 feet below sea level, in a truly desert town of Jericho. Jerusalem and much of Israel is kind of what we would call high desert. It's kind of the rocky scrub deserts that we have so many of in the American West. But here down, as you come down from the heights into the district of Jericho, what happens is that you come down into true desert, into the real sand deserts. But on the road, because you are descending almost at least a half a mile from the heights, that the road itself goes through canyons and crevices and gorges and all of that kind of thing, and was notorious for being a dangerous travel, a dangerous road because of all the hiding places where the brigands could hide. And so usually people would try to travel in groups if they went down from Jerusalem to Jericho for their protection. But here was a man who was traveling by himself, and the fate that awaits so many on that treacherous road awaited him as well. We presume then, and the presumption behind a lot of this is that it would be the Jews who were coming down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Jesus does not define the man as a Jew, but he is in all probability one, for it would be the Jews who were traveling that road. And when he says that the Levites and the priests come, which happens soon, it was because the city of Jericho was populated primarily by priestly families. And so after their duty and service at the temple, the priests and the Levites would come down the road from Jerusalem to Jericho back to their families. So one man on his way now has, in fact, been robbed and beaten and being left half dead. Now, a priest happened to be traveling down the same road, but when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So he was hurrying, a priest coming down from his temple duty, hurrying to get home, sees that there's someone half dead lying along the road, presumes there's nothing that can be done for him really, and hurries on his way. In the same way, a Levite came to the place and saw him, and pass by on the other side. And so the Levite also, returning home after temple service, is in a hurry to get home. The man is left half dead. Was it obvious that he was still alive? No one knows that. Did they just presume he was dead and not stop to bother to find out? Who knows that? It would seem more reasonable that they did, because it would be very difficult for a person to see someone lying on the road suffering and not in some way, shape, or form try to respond to that. On the other hand, Jesus might be trying to show, to create a very extreme situation of the definition of neighbor. And therefore, he never bothers really to let them know what the men, what the priests and the Levites observed. But then a Samaritan traveler came upon him, was moved with compassion when he saw him. The Samaritans, of course, were hated by the Jews, and they hated the Jews. We know, for instance, in some of the gospel stories, Jesus can't go through Samaria because he might be the subject of violence. Other times, of course, he goes through peacefully. But the Samaritans were seen as those people unwelcomed within Jewish society. They were the ones of the nation of Israel who was cut off from Judah and who mingled with the nations and adapted pagan elements into their practice of religion, and therefore became kind of abominations to the Jews. Who saw them as defiling Jewish rites and Jewish religion and the worship of God. And seeing that they defiled the worship of God, considered them lowly and unworthy people. And of course, the Samaritans, for their part, being stung by their rejection and criticism, hated the people who rejected and criticized them. A normal, unfortunately common human experience. So the Samaritan went up and bandaged his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. This is kind of interesting, too, because, you know, we would automatically presume if he poured wine on them, wine has alcohol, alcohol cleans out a wound, it kills germs, it tends to prevent infection and all of that kind of stuff. And so we see, and the oil probably would seal the wound from more germs coming in and so on and so forth. But that's really not exactly what was doing. They were seen as soothing elements, because the idea of germs and infection was not something that anyone was aware of until the middle of the 19th century. It's really kind of interesting in the story of the nurses in the Crimean War, under the supervision of Florence Nightingale. A small group of Irish Sisters of Mercy came. They had treated the cholera epidemics and so forth in Ireland. They had imbibed of the new science of infection and germs. And so when they came to the hospitals in the Crimea, they saw wounded soldiers lying in filth, their wounds untreated and left open, and obviously then dying of infection and disease and all of that kind of thing. When they proposed to clean the hospitals and wash the wounds of the wounded men, Florence Nightingale accused them of being superstitiously believing in this new fantasy of germs and infection, refused to allow them to do so, and sent them off, leaving the soldiers, of course, to die of infections. But it was considered to be a radically new science in the 1850s. And the famous Florence Nightingale, who we tend to have great respect and honor for, turned out to be the cause of the death of thousands because she refused to accept the science of her age, and she refused to allow those who did know what they were doing to save the lives of the soldiers. Kind of interesting. So, this idea then that he's not trying to prevent infection, he's trying simply to soothe the wound and to make the person feel better. He then goes the extra step, and not only does he tend to him lying on the ground alongside the road, but now he lifts him up on his own mount and carried him to the inn and looked after him. There was an inn on the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, where the travelers did tend to stay. And so, presumably, that's where the Good Samaritan took the wounded, beaten man. And then he took out 2 denarii and handed them to the innkeeper, which means that he said the next day he did that, which means he stayed with the man that night, tending to him and looking after him. And then the next day he gave 2 denarii. He had to be on his way to the innkeeper and says, look after him, and on my way back I will make good any other expense that you have. So he does the extraordinary. Not only does he treat the wounds, which those who were in a hurry did not do, he also puts him on his mount, gives him a ride to an inn, stays with him during the night to look after him, and then pays the innkeeper to look after him for the next few days while he goes about his business and returns to see how the man is doing. An interesting scenario, an interesting scenario. And so then what happens? Then Jesus, once he has done that, and this is fascinating, what law must I do? What thing must I do to be saved? And Jesus, it goads the lawyer into reciting the Shema Israel. And then he says, and then the man trying to justify himself and says, all right, but that's not the answer to the question. Because the real answer to the question is, who is my neighbor? And with the intention, as we see carried out, and Jesus is doing this deliberately, the priest and the Levite, who are of the chosen people, are not neighbors to one who is in need, presumably even one of their own. And so he says to them, can you find a law where they should have stopped? And of course there is no law that says if you see a man beaten alongside the road, you must stop and take care of him. But it is the question, it is the fulfillment of the law that Jesus is talking about. It's a very human situation, one which is easily understood, even by those who are the lawyers who are trying to disconcert Jesus, trying to trick Jesus. And so he says, fine, they might have been very justified by the law, by your laws, into what they were doing. But it was someone who was not bound by your particular laws, but bound by the law of Israel, the law of the Torah, the Shema Israel. It was one of those people who came and then did the extraordinary thing, not only of treating the wounds, of taking him to the inn, but staying with him during the night and then paying the innkeeper to look after him as he goes on his journey. And so which of these three do you think proved himself a neighbor to the man who fell in with the brigands? And so it was not the idea that the man lying on the ground was the neighbor. The idea was the Samaritan was the neighbor. He was a neighbor to someone. Love your neighbor as yourself. Who is the neighbor? The neighbor is the one who follows the law of Israel. And so he becomes the neighbor to the man who, because that man then becomes his neighbor as well. So it is through the good that this man did, the compassion, the human thing that he did, the kind thing that he did, the compassionate thing that he did, in obedience to the Shema Israel, in obedience to the law of Israel, to the Torah, that he therefore is demonstrated and shown to be the good neighbor to one who is in need. And the lawyer steps back and says, all right, the one who took pity on him. And Jesus said to him, well, then go and do the same yourself. and that go and do the same yourself, as we come to the very same conclusion that the lawyer came to, as we come to that conclusion, then Jesus also says to us, then go and do the same yourself. The question becomes then, we can ask ourselves too, who is our neighbor? What about panhandlers? What about jihadists? What about people with radically different political opinions than we ourselves have? What about people who are hostile to us and so forth? What about all that? Are they our neighbors? Are we obliged, therefore, to treat them as neighbors? And the answer turns upside down. The question is, are we neighbors to them? Are we the ones who heal the wounds? Are we the ones, for instance, who try to draw unbelievers into the faith? Are we the ones who tend to draw the radical secularists into a relationship with Jesus Christ? Are we the ones then who, when we see someone truly in need, are willing to extend ourselves to that person? This idea, for instance, in a very complex society like our own, when we talk about the poor, who are we talking about? It's a very complicated question. A very complicated question. They faced that question certainly during the 16th century, and it's kind of interesting because it gives us an insight into attempted solutions to this issue. But what they did, for instance, as the economy could not handle the population growth of the 16th century, you had automatically a whole class of beggars. And Catholicism at the time followed the idea of somehow or other extending charity to everyone who came your way. It's something we face the same problem with panhandlers on the streets and all of this kind of thing. It can become irritating. It can bothersome. We can say to ourselves, you know, are these people making tens of thousands of dollars a year begging on street corners? Or what is it that's going on around us? Are they mentally ill? Should they be in care? But of course, we have as a society taken away care facilities from those who are mentally ill and on the streets. And so in a way have kind of institutionally abandoned them. So what is our obligation? What is this whole thing all about? Well, in the 16th century, the Catholic idea was to extend as much charity as possible to all those who sought it. When the Protestant Reformation came, it was very interesting, especially in what they call the Church Orders of the North. And England did it also. They separated the poor into two categories, the worthy poor and the unworthy poor. The Germans called the worthy poor the Hausarmen, the ones who therefore were worthy of charity and the ones who were not worthy of charity. And so they passed laws forbidding beggars from coming into the cities and so forth, which caused them, of course, to be brigands in the countryside, because there was not an expansive enough economy to include them in the prosperity of the 16th century. So humanity tried to solve a problem. Catholicism was one of generosity and openness. The reform legislation, because so much of it was focused on local instead of on the universal idea of the church and the universality of the opportunity of salvation, tried to control more clearly the whole population of the local territories which they governed and for which they were accountable and responsible. Well, we find that same debate going on in our society today. So it's really difficult. When someone says, to whom should I be a neighbor? And we see people and we say, well, they're shiftless, they're lazy, they won't work, they're this, that, and the other thing. We ought to have tough love with them. And then we say, but these people, we know that there's been the father or the mother has died, or they've come on hard times, or they've lost their jobs, and all of these kinds of things. We have a tendency within our society, heavily influenced it is by the Reformation, to say, well, these are the worthy poor, and these we will take care of. What do we do with all this? What do we do? Because we face the challenge.
Go
and do the same. Well, we can go back to the story, therefore. It is not that we have responsibility to them because they are our neighbor. It is because we have responsibility to them because we are their neighbor. We are the one who stand under the law of the Shema Israel, under the law of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, under the law of the covenant, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And so everyone whom we care for and love, we are a neighbor to, and they conversely become our neighbor as well. But it is, in a sense, we fulfill the law when, in fact, we establish this neighborliness to others. And it's more difficult to today because of the massive society in which we live and all of the kind of huge charities that are at work, oftentimes not in the spirit of Christ, causing as much damage as they do good. And the federal government slowly takes away the capacity for personal charity, making it such that, for instance, the churches, and especially our church, cannot really do charitable work. I remember many years ago, at Mount Carmel Hospital, they used to have a charity ward, and government regulations forbade them to do that. And I remember the Sisters of the Holy Cross at that hospital, you know, questioning their role in hospital care if they were not able to fulfill the law of Israel, if they were not able to fulfill the law of the Shema Israel. Was it legitimate for them to run such a massive business when, in fact, there was no charitable outcome from it? So this is part of the complexity. It's not a simple answer for us, any more than it was a simple answer for the reformers and the Catholics in the 16th century. It's very complicated. But I think that the other part of the Shema Israel is where we find our guidance and our direction. You should love the Lord your God with your whole heart, your whole mind, your whole soul. If we truly love the Lord will guide our hearts to become a neighbor to others. If, in fact, we try to do it for sociological, political, altruistic reasons, we will probably mess it up. Let us then hear the word of the Lord to the lawyer in the gospel, and let us heed the great law of Israel. You love the Lord your God with your whole heart, your whole mind, your whole soul, and your neighbor as yourself. Doing this, we will inevitably fulfill the law of the love of neighbor.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com. Then he said,